Good morning. All right, we'll get started this morning. First of all, I want to welcome you and thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedules to be here, particularly those of you who work on the Hill. I know this is a very busy time as you're wrapping up and trying to get to the end of this period of the session. As we start this morning, though, I want to take a few minutes to offer a few thank yous so you know who helped us get to this room. I want to start by thanking the Brookings Center on Children and Families, particularly Ron Haskins and Julie Clover for the work they have done in helping put this series together for you and to guide us in how to make this the best possible resource. I'd also like to thank our cooperating organizations for this briefing series, which include Child Trends, the National Conference on State Legislators, the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, and CLASP. All of those organizations have really helped us, again, learn how to frame these kind of briefings for you as it's sort of our first attempt at this kind of effort. I do want to thank the Administration for Children and Families for the funding they provide to the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center. And this morning, I especially want to thank the Annie Casey Foundation, who funds this briefing series, and Carol Thompson, who is here on the end, who is our project officer and has provided great guidance to us about how this might be helpful and useful to you. And also this morning from the Annie Casey Foundation, we have Dana Vickers-Shelley, who is the Strategic Communications Director, and she'll be our moderator this morning, and you'll learn a little bit more about her in a moment. My name is Mary Myrick, and I'm the Project Director for the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center. I spend most of my time on the road around the country visiting healthy marriage programs, but sometimes I live in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And I want to thank the members of the Resource Center team who might be here this morning. We have partners with ICF Caliber, the Lewin Group, and the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence. So thank you to you all for the work you do to make the Resource Center what it is. So I want to talk about, just for a second, the goals of the series. In 2002, ACF began funding healthy marriage programs, and since that time they funded about 300 programs in communities and cities across this country. And so last year, as we began thinking about where we were and sort of evolving this public policy area, we began to decide that maybe it was time to start sharing some of what was learned, because there really hadn't been any follow-up to those initial discussions about what this policy initiative might look like. And as we did that, we began to talk to many of you about what you thought would be helpful and what questions you thought people might have about this initiative. And we decided, as a result of that, to try to focus on three key areas where people had had questions about what this might be and what this might not be. So we began a briefing series in May, and at that first meeting, Ron Haskins led a panel of researchers who focused on how healthy marriage affects child well-being and family income. And equally as important, we had two couples, one from Baltimore, Maryland, and one from Oklahoma City, who shared their experiences by being involved in the program. One of the couples was not married, one was married, and both of them shared about the impact this has had on their couple relationship and also their family. In July, Oliver Williams and Ann Menard from the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence partnered with us, and we talked about how and why the domestic violence community was working closely with healthy marriage programs across this country to make sure that these services were done in a way that participants were safe and that they had an opportunity to learn about what healthy relationships might look like. At that briefing, we were also able to meet a program participant from the Northern Midwest who shared her experience about participating in a healthy marriage program, where she learned about what a healthy relationship looked like, and as a result, she left an abusive relationship. At the same time, we saw video clips of fathers who shared their experiences about being involved with abusive relationships, and we were able to talk about ways that these programs are helping to create healthy models for a different way of thinking about how relationships might play out. If you missed either of those, you can follow up by going to the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center website, where there are transcripts and audio tapes of those briefings, so it'll be almost like being there, except there won't be food. Today we're focusing on the last issue that people really had questions about, and that was the cultural competency of these programs. When the first healthy marriage programs were first introduced, for the most part, they had been developed for and had been implemented in middle-class white family communities for couples in that community. And as ACF and states began funding programs, people began to ask questions about, would these same kind of services work for more vulnerable populations? And so a number of things have been done to address those concerns and to make sure that disadvantaged and culturally diverse populations could benefit and that the services would be relevant and effective for them. So you're going to hear today from panelists who are going to talk about how they've been involved in adapting program design, outreach activities, curricula, and other things to make sure that these services are relevant to the people that they serve. And I'm very excited about that work and think you will be as well. And then the final thing I want to say is that there are many cultures who have been represented in the roles of these programs, and certainly we could not have all of them here. But today we're going to focus on African American, Latino, and Native American populations. We know, however, that there are Asian Pacific Americans, refugees and migrants from places like Africa, the Middle East, and Central Europe, who have participated in programs and communities, and at some point we'd hope to share their stories as well. So I did want to say that this group is representative of the work that's being done, but certainly not all-inclusive of what is happening to adapt these programs. So with that, I'd like to turn the program over to Patrick Patterson, who is the program manager for the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center. And he's the person on a day-to-day basis who makes sure that the Resource Center works and meets the needs that you have. And so Patrick, take it away.
Thank you, Mary. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. It's Friday. This has been recorded. I shouldn't have said that, right? I want to do a couple things. First, again, to join Mary and welcome you guys to our briefing. This is our third this year. We're very pleased. Some of us see this as graduation for the year because we put a lot of work into this. We've done our, I think, homework in advance about how we focus these topics, and we're very delighted that you guys are here to join us. One of the things I want to just bring your attention to is each of you should have received a binder as you walked in. The binder is specifically unique to the fact that it captures the history of ACF funding for these programs. We've tried to chronicle that correctly by asking the key people at ACF about the work. But also we've tried to capture in each of these briefings research and resources that support why these briefings are important and the data that supports that. So if you look, there are three tabs that are specifically focused on these briefings. The second tab focuses on the first briefing that we had that Mary talked about that kind of educated folks about what is healthy marriage. The second tab, or actually the number three tab, focuses on our domestic violence and healthy marriage briefing and what that was all about. And if you go to tab four, you'll see where we actually have the resources and information related to this specific briefing for today. That's very important for two reasons. One is we won't get into reading the bios of our presenters, but their bios are there along with the resource information about their programs that they represent. Our agenda will follow as it reads. We'll have a first panel that will answer questions after their presentations, and then we'll have a second panel. We'll make a shift where our second panel of presenters will come up and also field questions after their presentations. Very key for us, very important as we consider doing something like this or these next year, is the evaluations. They should either be in your chair, which I think they are. Before you leave is actually your ticket to get out of this room. There are two doors. You will not leave without giving us your evaluation. So please take the time to fill out the evaluations as we conclude. My last duty, which I'm pleased to do this morning, is to introduce our moderator. We've had a few conversations in advance of this briefing, so we're very delighted to have Ms. Dana Vickers-Shelley join us as our moderator. Dana has extensive experience in public affairs, working in both the business, private, and political sectors. She's worked in the Clinton administration here as well as abroad, and is now Director of Strategic Communications at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which is one of our supporters for the Resource Center. She's a masterful communicator in our couple conversations, and we're privileged and delighted to have her join us as our moderator. So please join me in welcoming Dana Vickers-Shelley as our moderator.
Good morning, and to be heard is key to communications, isn't it? That's okay. Good morning again. What I'd like to do is start with questions to Diane Dawson, who's Director of Regional Operations at the Administration for Children and Families, where she provides leadership and direction across the country to 10 regional offices. And most important for our seminar today, she is the co-founder and lead of the African American Healthy Marriage Initiative. So welcome, Diane.
Thank you.
Diane, your training as a lawyer and social worker and as a civil servant in the government, working for both Democrats and Republicans, you've seen a lot of initiatives, I'm sure, come and go, perhaps. I'm just wondering, for our audience as we begin today, if you could tell us, what was your first reaction when Wayne Hort announced the Healthy Marriage Initiative at the Department of Health and Human Resources, Health and Human Services Administration for Children and Families? What was your first reaction?
Okay, am I on? I need to do the same. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I guess my reaction was probably like most folks. I was saying, what does the government have to do with marriage, you know? I was, amazed at some of the conversation as Wade began to make the case for marriage and what it meant for the well-being of children. I really took it seriously and began to listen, and it started to make a lot of sense. It made a lot of sense to me because, as Dana mentioned in terms of my resume, I've been working in government at state and federal levels in social welfare for some 30-some years. And when I started to think about, you know, what it meant to have strong families, some of the things that I really thought about most was that, you know, if we had strong families, we wouldn't have the disproportionate number of our children in the child welfare system. I began to think about if, you know, we had both mom and dad and that they were employed and they were able to sustain and strengthen their families, we wouldn't have some of the other issues that we have to deal with. And so as I began to think about that those issues in the context, I began to think about it like, why not look at relationships and what it might mean if it meant that we would have stronger families. I think it got real for me when I attended the first Smart Marriages Conference. And I realized that there were people who had been studying and researching and had curricula, and this was indeed a marriage movement. And there were no black people. I mean, it was just like, how did we not know about this, or how were we not involved in this? And I think, Dana, from the standpoint of looking at the fact that there were so many issues that I felt weren't addressed, that we, if we were to look at this issue for the African American community, we needed to talk about some other things that were not being discussed in that particular venue. And so I went back to Wade with my colleagues, and we talked about, you know, if this was going to be something that really was intended to be for all communities, then we would have to have a discussion with the community, and we would have to address those issues in a culturally competent way.
And to allude to Mary's point and in her opening remarks, I understand that three of the African American ACF regional administrators, Carlos Williams, Joyce Thomas, and Leon McGowan, with them you decided you needed to work as part of an initiative to really launch a marriage initiative for the African American community. Why did you think that was important to do specifically with that team, and what were your goals when you began?
Well, for one reason, they report to me, so that was real easy.
Okay.
We need help.
So
here,
you immediately had their support.
I mean,
okay.
Yes. That's a good way to start something. But I do think we all shared, some of the same thinking. I mean, when you look at the statistics, and it was something like, it was real for us, you know. Mm-hmm. When you think about the number of single-headed households in the African American community, and yet, the high out-of-wedlock birth rate and the association with who was in the system in terms of needing the income support and the other things. But we also knew that to have that discussion, we couldn't talk about it just in terms of the deficits. We had to really think hard about how could we have a conversation that was so desperately needed but it had to be addressed in a competent way. We knew it was never going to go over if it was about white people telling black people how to be married or to marry. It just was not going to work. And so one of the things that we did is that we decided that we really needed to bring a group of people together to help us think about how to develop that blueprint about going forth, thinking about this being a national conversation around marriage and the well-being and the benefits of marriage and why that we needed to reconsider marriage in our communities. We did that by, we had a round table. We just met 2 days with a diverse group of people. They were from academia, they were from the faith community, they were from the arts, they were young, they were people who, we just sat around a table for 2 days and talked about how do we think about addressing this issue in our community. And as a result of it, we went back, the team, and really began to think about how we could use our influence as, first of all, people who worked in the government, but also who were also of the community and could speak to these issues and think about what was the best way to begin to engage the community.
And in the policy community, we often use the word cultural competence, and we use that with quotations on either side. What do you think that phrase means, and why is that important? Why is cultural competency important?
Well, let me talk about it in terms of what I think cultural competence means in the context of marriage and the strategies for marriage in the African American community. You know, it's just so important, and I think we can see this, especially, you know, you look at the political debate going on. It's the most interesting thing to me that I've ever seen. And you think about, you know, the issues around how do you get information in a way that and share it so that people can connect to it, that they can identify with it, that they can see it in the context of their own lives and the shared experiences of as a group. And, you know, for African Americans, you know, there's a lot of shared history, and a lot of it comes out of the enslaved experience in this country, the racial discrimination. And so when you start talking about, well, how do you talk about and know that that's always in the backdrop of how people see themselves and see their life and see their experience and therefore see their families. How do you begin to look at that in a way that you come to it knowing that you speak to it in the context of that experience? And I think that, you know, that's what has to be done for all of us. I remember the first time that someone from a Latino person said, well, where is the Latino one? And I said, I can't do that. You will need to find somebody to be there because I can't, you know, there are lots of other experiences that I would not be able to. And there was Frank,
right,
you know. So, you know, that again, that's sort of why we came to it, not that it was a mandate, even though it was a government priority, but we really felt that this was important. We knew that the issues were complex and that we needed to really take this seriously about how do we as a community look at the issues and also look at how we could resolve some of the problems.
And as the African American Healthy Marriage Initiative was conducted with all different kinds of activities from regional conferences and you work with religious community and other folks, I'm just wondering, did you have challenges in trying to sell this to the African American community when you went either to pastors or civic leaders or residents in communities? What was that experience like?
Yes, and we still do. But I can tell you, part of our strategy was to go directly to the communities, to really look at developing the sort of the coalition strategy. And we have met so many wonderful people all over this country who care about this issue, who are doing this work even though they didn't get a federal grant. I think that we are now beginning to see some of the national organizations that we knew really could bring and contribute to this discussion beginning to come on board. That probably has been the biggest challenge, has been sort of the organizations that you think naturally who have constituencies that would be an easier way to bring the conversation. But it has required us to do this from the bottom up. I think that, you know, there's still a lot we can do with the faith community. I think a lot of it is just people know that these are issues, but they just don't know how to do it. And so as we have developed the initiative and as we have begun to actually get some of the research that's more targeted and focused to the community, we're able now to be one of the players who can bring some of those resources to the various groups who want to participate but just don't, haven't figured out how to come to the table in the conversation.
Thank you, Diane. And in our next couple of minutes, I wanted to ask, as a last question at this point, what do you think are the one or two most important lessons that you've learned through working with the African American Healthy Marriage Initiative about the relevance of the Healthy Marriage Initiative overall that apply to the African American community?
Well, I think one of the lessons clearly is that it is relevant, very relevant. I think the other lesson is that there's a lot of interest in this work. There's interest from the young people. There's interest by men, women, and as I say, the young people. I think that they see the value in committing themselves to being a part of this of the programs and the services. I think they. We have seen that a lot of people think they see themselves as mentors, that they've got something to contribute. I think that people are more open to learning more information about it. And I think that another lesson is that when you bring these conversations to people and use others who can speak to their audiences, that people get it. It's not difficult for people to understand a relationship.
Okay, terrific. Now I'd like to move and introduce Frank Fuentes, who, like Diane, you've worked for many years in the federal government in different positions with different administrations, and currently you're Deputy Director of Head Start and the lead for the Hispanic Healthy Marriage Initiative. And you've seen a variety of the initiatives come and go. I guess I'd start with the same question. What was your response when Wade Horn said, "Hi, Frank, guess what we're going to start doing?"
Well, when Wade launched this initiative, I had known him for about 15 years, and I thought he had gone out of his mind, to be honest. And what reinforced that was the early dialogue in the press, in the community's reaction from the different interest groups, national organizations. And I said to myself, I have enough work to do. I don't need to get myself involved in this. But after 34 years of working in primarily human service child and family programs, early Head Start, child care, runaway homeless youth, domestic violence, what became very, very clear, and most importantly, as the rhetoric modified itself and became sort of more encompassing and nuanced, my reaction was the same as Diane's. It's like, this makes sense. I had spent at that point about 30 years working on the deficits and approaching the needs of families from that perspective, and here was truly for the first time some effort at the flip side of the coin. From a preventative standpoint, that would begin to address really some of the very root causes of why we had Head Start and child abuse and neglect and foster care and all of those sort of corrective programs for what is best for kids. So when it became about what is best for children, I had no problem signing up.
Great. And what relevance do you see that healthy marriage goals in general have for the Latino and Hispanic populations?
I think, what I've learned and experienced is that it has resonated to the core of the Latino community. One of the first things that Wade asked me to do was to take 6 months before launching an initiative and travel the country and talk to lots of different communities, different leaders, different individuals, and so I did that. And I would have to say, with rare exception, the response was, where have you been and why has it taken so long? We have needed this. It didn't matter whether I talked with people who were working with at-risk youth or folks who were, you know, providing childcare or people who were running, you know, child protective services. What they kept saying time and time again is, our money comes in these categorical silos, and what we really need to do is to engage the parents, but we don't have the resources, or we are constrained from doing so. And so here was a real avenue for folks to begin to address these very critical needs. And I believe that the reason is, quite honestly, that there is still in the Latino community a strong core value of family, which is also one of the differences that I wanted to make sure that this initiative understood as we went forward in the Latino community. And so a lot of the research that we've done, a lot of the technical assistance is really first identifying what those unique aspects of this core value of family in the Latino community, and to build on that, because we were beginning to see some real erosions in that area. 60% of Hispanic women 15 to 58 are or have been married. So you can see that there is a huge commitment to the institution of marriage in the Latino community. However, the divorce rates are no better, perhaps marginally better. But we began to see issues of the dropout rate, which is twice that of anybody else, out of wedlock birth rates, lots of these indicators that lead to a perpetuation of poverty that leads to 33% of the Hispanic kids in this country still living in poverty. So when you talk about this initiative and how the research is showing that all things being equal, you can begin to turn that around, it was really a very relevant, both in terms of what we were seeing in the community, but also to build on the strengths of the culture.
And something that I wanted to ask along the lines as you're just bringing up culture, I know when you did your initial listening tour talking with various folks in the community, what were some of the key issues that you saw that were particularly germane in the Latino population in terms of communication, culture, et cetera?
Well, you know, obviously language is one of the first things. But being bilingual is not going to be enough. You really need to understand the culture and the relevance and the experience of the families that are coming. I hate to say that sometimes we have, you know, professionals, particularly that come from other Latin American countries, who speak the language but can't quite connect with the reality of the population that is here, immigrating here, because there is this huge social divide. Mm-hmm. So speaking the language is not in and of itself important, but not solely. Understanding the culture, being able to take curricula that, you know, as Diane said, were developed for middle class, you know, Anglo couples and families, and to adapt that in a way that is relevant and responsive to the Hispanic community. One of the key aspects that we learned early on and sort of confirmed it already was the issue of immigration, another unique difference. I mean, the immigrant experience, 36% of the Hispanic population is immigrant. Mm-hmm. The impact on that, the impact of acculturation, the fact that 38% of the 44 million Hispanics in this country are 18 years old or younger, and the fact that many of our services don't allow us to spend federal money on reaching that population, when we know that they, in the Latino community, marry and have children much younger than anybody else. Mm-hmm. So those are, you know, some of the lessons that we've learned and the aspects of the initiative that we have tried to address, again, through written materials, conferences, technical assistance, to not just Hispanic organizations that are serving Latinos, but to non-Hispanic organizations that need to understand how best to engage, and that the messenger is just as important as the message.
Key, thank you. What I'd like to ask as a next question, and then ask Diane to respond to this as well, what would you like to tell the new administration, the next Congress? Everyone in the room is going to be asked this question. What will, when you are in front of the next, you know, president, what are you going to say about the directions you think the Hispanic Healthy Marriage Initiative and what the country can learn from that?
Right. I think First of all, just make it clear, I'm a civil servant, so I'm not telling any particular party anything. Got to put that disclaimer there.
This is January 25th,
January 25th, okay. If you know, being asked my advice, what I would basically say is that there is a resounding need in the country. We believe from the statistics and Dr. Laos, which will be part of the next panel, I think can confirm the kind of demand that is out there, the urgency of that need, the fact that we continue to need research focused on the Hispanic population. There has been a dearth of research, not just on this issue, but allied areas. Mm-hmm. With our partners in the department and in the ACF, we've launched an evaluation of the current Hispanic Healthy Marriage Initiative, but we need to build on what that tells us. So I think more attention from that perspective, and clearly to look at moving the Healthy Marriage Initiative to encompass the life, all aspects of the life of families.
Terrific, thank you. And Diane, let me ask you as well regarding the African American Healthy Family Initiative.
Well, I think I would say, based on some of the lessons that we've learned already, even though we don't have all of the conclusions about how well these programs have been implemented, that it's very clear that we need more of it so that the programs can be delivered where the people live. That we need to have these programs more culturally sensitive to the issues. And that doesn't mean, in my opinion, that they have to be delivered solely by African Americans, but that we need more of the programs so that more of the people who have implemented curricula can look like the community. And that we need to tailor more of these programs for the youth. That programs for adults are not the same for youth, and that there's such a great need for that. And that, you know, we need to develop these programs with the community. They can't just be canned programs. And I think that says to me that there needs to be a commitment, a continual commitment, to funding these programs at the federal level. I think that research is another area. I've been really amazed about, as we try to identify and bring African American researchers to this work, that there's a lot of interest, but there's just not the funding to support a lot of it at the scale that we need it. I think that I would say to the new administration that one of the things I think that we need to continue to support the research in this area. I think that we need to do what we can to encourage more state and more local funding of the programs, as well as the private sector, because I do think that this marriage education and the research and all of the other strategies that we've implemented, that it needs to be in the arsenal of tools that we have to address some of the issues and help families in terms of poverty and as well as health outcomes. And so that's what I would say.
Okay, terrific. I think what we'd like to do is open it up to questions to the audience. If you have questions that you'd like to raise with either of our panelists. And while you're thinking of those questions, what I'll do is let Diane and Frank, who...
Can I put in a plug?
Well, I was going to say, this is the sponsored by, this is an opportunity actually for the two of you to have a couple of discussions just between yourself as the audience thinks of what questions it might want to ask. It's Friday, and people are thinking of maybe next week's debate that they're going to be tuning into as well. But this isn't a debate. We're on the same page.
Well, I just wanted to share with you, and hopefully you'll pick these up as you leave or you've gotten them as you came in. It's just one of the examples of the materials that we have put together to be of assistance, inform, educate, motivate, particularly the large number of healthy marriage grantees that are serving Hispanic populations but don't really have an inroad into the community or have staff that can help them do that. And so this is designed as some sort of successful efforts on the part of just a few. This is a work in progress. We will continue to add to this information. But again, one more example of what we have learned, both from research as well as from looking at the experience of the practitioners.
Okay. There's a question. Oh. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Naomi Goldstein, and I work with Diane and Frank at the Administration of Children and Families. And you know, much of the time that we interact, it's about everyday stuff, which keeps us all very busy. And I know, and I'm well aware that you both have played this bigger picture visionary role. And I'm actually very interested in how you have maintained your momentum and your ability to focus and give time to this kind of work in light of the day-to-day pressure.
Ladies first.
Well, you know, I live, Naomi, by this thing, this quadrant, and you know, the things you have to do and all of that. But I truly focus on what I try to think of the things that really make an impact and make a difference. So it just forces me to make sure that I'm doing some of that work in that quadrant. It is tough in many ways, but I think that, and especially tough when you don't have the money to do some of the things that you know would be ideal. But I think I'm encouraged every day when I get calls from people and they still want to know, how do I become a part of the HMI? And I'm like, you know, it really is not a thing, you know what I mean? It's sort of, it's just fascinating. And I just find that that's what keeps me going, because I do know that, you know, this is an idea whose time has come, and that people are working on these issues and thinking about this and really trying to figure out how they can personally commit themselves. And it makes me know that I have to personally commit myself in terms of my time. So it's been one of the most fulfilling experiences I've had.
Great. And just to remind everyone, and Ms. Goldstein set the perfect example, to please speak up and identify yourself before you ask your question or make your comment. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry.
Actually, can you stand up? Oh, so the microphone mentioned. Andrea King with the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. And I'd be interested, Diane, you talked a little bit about some of the particular interests you're hearing from youth. I think Frank, you mentioned that a little bit too. And I think it'd be interesting to hear a little bit more about what are you hearing from young people? What do you think we need to do differently when we're trying to reach young people rather than adults who already have children? And sort of what's your vision for the next couple of years on what we need to do in that area?
What I'm going to do is start with Frank to respond to that.
Oh, okay. Actually, I was thinking about my answer to the other question, but that's all right. I just went out to Chicago and visited Dr. Laos's program, Family Bridges. And the first session that we went to was a junior high school ninth grade class, and watched these 12-year-olds express a depth of experience and understanding that just blew me away. They talked about the core values of a sort of a beginning relationship, a growing relationship, and then a mature relationship, and all the, you know, and so lack of, you know, unselfishness was, you know, one of the core. And so they said, well, you know, when you get married, you know, part of that commitment is not being selfish. And one little girl said, there are a lot of selfish married people, all right? And then they brought up commitment. You know, commitment is about the long term and so on and so forth. Another little boy said, well, you know, commitment goes away because people get divorced all the time. And then she talked about love and how love is, you know, I love chocolate, I love my mother, I love my wife, I love my girlfriend, it's all the same word. So she broke it down, which sort of really blew me away, into eros and agape, and tried to put some English terms to those two distinctions, and then whipped out a bunch of words, and there was, okay, does this belong under lust, or does it belong under love? And so they did that little exercise, and then she showed them this picture and said, okay, tell me where this one belongs. And it was of a young woman sitting on a fellow's lap. They were looking at each other, kind of smiling at one another. And the fellow had, you know, his hand on her knee. She had her arms around his back. And she said, well, where does this one belong? And so a couple of kids, you know, well, he's got his hand on her knee, you know, that's got to be lust, et cetera. But they finally came down to, no, that was love. And then she flashed this other one with a bare-chested guy, a young woman with a halter top, midriff all hanging out, all over each other. And so this one little boy just jumped up and said, that is lust. You know, they took that curriculum and turned it into the reality of a very poor neighborhood and the children who live with these realities day in and day out. And I think that we need to look at the flexibilities that we could put into these programs and build on that experience of what is working and where does that take us next. We know, as I mentioned before, for the Latino community, it is not unusual to have a 17-year-old husband and a 16-year-old wife. So how do we make sure that we are getting that information about choices and options and skills to them early enough, which in many instances we can't right now? So I think we need to look at that aspect of reaching kids.
Thank you.
Diane. You still okay? Just a couple of things. Andrea, you know, our young people, many of them don't see a lot of success in relationships. They haven't seen a lot of success. So they are very interested in wanting to know how can they not make that same mistake. And so I think from the standpoint of what adults can do and help in terms of what young people's interest in their relationships and that kind of thing is that, first of all, being honest and sharing with them. I think what we have tried to do is also give success models, have some mentors that kids feel like they could feel comfortable talking to those folks. Because I think many times we have forgotten to share share our experiences, that it's not easy to be married, that, you know, it takes work, and that, you know, all of what goes into making sure that you try to have a successful marriage. And the kids are interested. And what I'm finding is that they're interested at ages that I wouldn't even think they would be thinking about it. But they live in a different time than when I grew up, when you just assumed that mom and dad were going to be there, and that was just that. Where else could they go, you know, kind of thinking. And so we're living in a very different time, and I do think that the fact that we believe that we can impart some education and some skills and that people can learn what it takes, even if they haven't always seen it, that experience, is something that I think is very hopeful about this marriage work.
Excellent. I want to thank our panelists for this first part of the program this morning. Please join me in thanking them. Thank you very much. And I'd like to have our next panel please come up and we'll get situated.